thanks for tuning in. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. The show airs every Saturday night at midnight. Until next time, have a great night, folks, and take care of yourselves.
WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio, the mother of community radio in Cape Town, South Africa. I'm Ricky Hubert, and you are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm broadcasting from New York. We'll be a very exciting guest in London today, Mr. Chris Nightingale, who is the composer, the orchestrator, and the arranger of A Christmas Carol that's playing here in New York City. Chris, thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome. It's lovely to be here.
So, Chris, for those who aren't aware, because there's different cultures, different places that listen to the show all over the world, can you kind of explain what the story of A Christmas Carol is?
Sure. Basically, the story is of a man, Ebenezer Scrooge, who is at a stage in his life where he's become embittered, angry, frustrated at life. And he's kind of forgotten, he's lost his way, I think probably is the best way of describing it. He doesn't know who he is anymore. And he works incredibly hard. And he, let's be honest, he's exploitative. And he works every single hour that there is. And the people who work for him, Bob Cratchit works for him, is worked to the bone by him. And it comes up to Christmas, it's Christmas Eve. And he's visited by a ghost. He's visited by Jacob Marley, who used to be his partner, who's now dead. But he sees him as a vision. And Marley tells him that he's going to be visited by three spirits. And Scrooge, to cut a long story short, is visited by the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. And they all show him different things and different versions of his life. And in the end, they remind him what life is and what it was for him when he was a child and what his hopes and aspirations might have been. And I don't want to know if I can give away the ending. I should give away the ending. I think everyone knows the ending. The ending is he discovers who he is and why, what he's lost all over again. And instead of being miserly and nasty, he converts and he has a road to Damascus moment, and he becomes generous and loves Christmas. I've actually described that. It's much better than the way I've described it.
And if you could tell us a little bit about the history of this production that you've been working on. We were talking a bit before we got on the air that this has been in the works. It's been in London, it's been in New York, it's been all over the place, and it's been in people have been doing this for about 10 years or so. Talk about the history of this production and how it all came to be.
Sure thing. Well, it was actually, so Matthew Warchus is the director of it, spoke to his team, of kind of loyal team of people, whether it's me and the designer and sound designer, lighting designer. When we were in New York doing another production, I think we were doing Groundhog Day at the time, and he said he'd just taken over the Old Vic. So the Old Vic is this very famous theatre in London, and he was the artistic director, and he thought he would love to do, as he described it, a community production of A Christmas Carol. And I have to say, we were all a little moany about it and thought, seriously, does the world really need another production of A Christmas Carol? It's been done so many times and so brilliantly. What have we got to offer that's new? He was adamant that there was a production there, and that it had to do with community and sharing and all that stuff, and the audience becoming very involved. And he won us over 9 years later, because it's now the ninth year. It's still at the Old Vic, which is quite shocking, really, for us skeptics. But it's somehow been taken into people's Christmas tradition. I think there's return audience who just love it every year, and they come back and they listen to it again and again, or watch it again and again. And we've been lucky enough to be on Broadway, which we were, I can't remember the year now, was it 2020, something like that. And it still is playing in Melbourne, Australia, and there's rumors of all sorts of other places that it might travel to. But yeah, that's kind of the broad history.
So it starts with an idea of Matthew being like, oh, we should do this production, make it immersive and interactive. And how did he get you guys on board? Because it's obviously, art is a very expensive thing to make, and you were all very skeptical about it. How did he recruit everybody?
Well, Matthew's got sort of kind of very strong powers of persuasion. And, you know, I think all of us found a little our own particular way in. I know Rob Howe, the designer, found a way in by thinking of the shape of the stage, and that, you know, in London and a little bit to a certain extent on Broadway, the stage thrusts into the audience. So the audience are really part of it. They're sitting all around, and certainly at the Parliament now, it's in the round, I know. So the audience are all around the production. We all had our different kind of routes to try and, you know, mostly we're just scared of making a mistake with it. And as soon as we felt confident that we weren't going to make a mistake, that's probably the moment that we all joined in. And for me, musically, that was when I thought about my way in was I was thinking, well, what would the music sound like at that time in, I guess, I think it's 1843 or something, in mid-1840s. If you were walking around London at that time, what would you have heard? And I thought, well, you might hear folk music. I think there'd probably been quite a lot of folk music, you know, street corners and things, people with little instruments, fiddles and stuff playing. And you might walk past an open window where you'd hear someone playing the piano, maybe, you know, maybe quite formally, Victorian formal music. And then, of course, there's Christmas carols, which have been around us forever. So as soon as that, had thought about that and thought that there is a way, a kind of key to the door, we all became quite keen. And I think it was the same for all of his kind of creative team. We had to cross that bridge.
And what was that first year like mounting it at the Old Vic? What was kind of the response? What did you say? Oh, we have to shift this, change this here. What was the audience response to it the first time you did it?
Well, I think that's the moment when we thought we really are on, or Matthew has really sussed it out here, because, you know, as you may know, when people walk into the theatre, they're immediately kind of hit by a smell of oranges and satsumas and mince pies and, you know, treats, basically, for everyone, with actors walking around amongst the audience and giving stuff out. And immediately there's this kind of sense of celebration and community. And I think we realised, really, as soon as the curtain came up on the actual show, that the audience were completely on side. I don't know quite, I've never seen anything quite like it. I think they just feel at home in there. They feel that they're part of the story, you know, as opposed to it being presented to them quite so much. I think that was the moment where we really thought, hang on, this is quite cool. And we hadn't anticipated it. And to be fair to Matthew, he really had all along. That's what he had envisaged.
So how many years has it been playing at the Old Vic now?
Well, this is its ninth year. What does that mean? 2016? Gosh, it can't be really that long, but I guess it is. 2025. Yeah, it's its ninth.
And you've mentioned that it played. The reason why I was so excited to do this is because I saw the 2019 Broadway production. I went with my parents. We sat up in the rafters. We sat up all the way in the balcony. And I just remember seeing it and that feeling of you were walking into someone's party, because I remember someone's Christmas party. The cast was coming around the aisles and they were handing out and they were playing with snowballs. And they're even in this production now, in reading about it online, it's very funny. The Paramount Center, they have something where it's like, if you have allergies to gingerbread, please let us know, because we're going to be handing stuff out to you. It just felt like a very fun, festive Christmas party. And people were waving to you and you felt very much like you were a part of it and connected to the story. How is the production, what made you want to say, oh, let's go from London, now we're going to go to New York, we're going to go to Australia, I know you've done it in California. How have you been able to take it all over the world, really?
Well, I tell you, you've put it much better than me. It's like you're walking into someone's Christmas party. That's perfectly, it's exactly right. That's the feeling that the audience has. And I guess it's no different wherever you are from, is it? I mean, everyone has their own kind of festive traditions. You know, for people who celebrate Christmas, they have their own Christmas traditions. You know, I guess it doesn't really matter whether you're in New York or whether you're in Australia or wherever you are, or South Africa. I mean, it might be different weather, but I know that tradition and nostalgia is the key. So probably it's that sense of nostalgia is the thing that has managed to help it transfer to all these different places, plus a sense of fun. People are genuinely uplifted by the experience and by the show. especially when things can, are a bit dark now, nowadays, you know, it's difficult not to get a bit depressed by the news. It's just a very simple story of redemption and fun. And as you say, it's a Christmas party. I suspect that's the reason why it's transferred so well.
And I remember also an audience member, I guess you could say this on the show, an audience member gets dragged up on stage and is a part of it because it's like a game of some sort. And then, it's just like an interactive thing. And it was fun because we were rooting for the audience member. And it just becomes one of those interactive things. You feel like you're a part of it. It feels like a party. And I guess something that's interesting about this show that we do is because, again, like you were saying, we're all different cultures. But essentially, the themes are people want the same things. People are interested. There was a show we did about animals, and there's been shows about illnesses, and it's just like disabilities. And we all have the same kind of core and compassion and empathy and humanity. And I think that's why the story of Scrooge, because it is a story of hope, as you've been saying. It's a story of hope. And I think that's why it does transfer so well. I think you're right about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And redemption, you know, and people get, if I'm honest, I feel, I don't want to say that I have an affinity to Scrooge. I really don't, because I don't. But I do understand that somewhere along in his life, he got lost in himself, and he got lost in his work, and, you know, his commitments. And, you know, they're modern day equivalents of that for everyone. People, you know, I think especially now, I want to re-examine as I reach my 60th year, you know, I want to re-examine what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. So there are all these resonances, and actually it doesn't matter whether you celebrate Christmas or any other festival at that time of year. These are the same human experiences, aren't they, for everyone? And also that feeling of nostalgia, which doesn't change. Again, it doesn't make any difference what festival you're particularly celebrating, but, you know, nostalgia is a big one for Christmas.
And we were discussing the joy. And again, it is a very human story. I think we can all, even as we've been discussing this and I've been thinking about the story more, I've seen, not that I think I'm a Scrooge, but there is a little bit of that character in all of us. We get lost in different things we're doing that we kind of miss out on the fun and the joy that is around us. And I think that is human, especially as you get a little bit older. Not that I'm old. I'm in university still. But, and not that you're old either, Chris. I wasn't trying to imply that. But I think you do get... yeah. I think you do get a little lost in things. And I think that's part of why the joy of this production is so... it's coming at you so much. And you leave the theater feeling it. And I think a way into that is the music. I remember the music is originally what made me want to go see this. And I remember just seeing, like, the B-roll of it. And when they were singing God Rest You Merry Gentlemen and how festive and fun it was. And everybody's clapping at the end. Tell us about, we've discussed Rob Howell's way in with the design. What was your way in musically? How'd you uncrack the code with this?
Well, I think the code for me was, as I say, was trying to find some kind of a route to what the sound of that world was at that time in the 1840s in London. I mean, it's not like we're necessarily trying to create a historical piece. I suppose there is a kind of historical aspect to it. But, you know, it's not any music score doesn't want to sound like a museum, you know, a thing from a museum. But I did think, well, a key for me was the instrumentation. I knew that I had limits on the number of people I could have playing in the band, in the little orchestra. And I had to choose quite carefully what those might be. And I think that is the key. The key for me was thinking of folk. In particular, you know, like folk fiddle and folk whistle and some accordion and things like that. Just, you know, piano being played. I think piano was a favorite instrument at that time, luckily, because that's my instrument. And then, of course, there are the carols. The carols themselves, you know, the one thing that the carols convey, this word I keep using, but is a sense of nostalgia. And I mean, certainly for me. So I tried to create, I thought that is the best adjective of all for any composer to have is to write to is nostalgia, because it's actually a lovely, warm thing, kind of idea to return to. You know, it could be, it depends on what the production of it is. You know, you're writing music for a film, and it could be write a scary score, or write, you know, action or this and that. But nostalgia is just a really lovely thing for any composer, I think. So it's probably a combination of those things: folk, Victorian formality, nostalgia and the carols themselves, and trying to find how we could weave the carols into the story. Those were the keys in. And then you get the fancy things like bells and handbells, which I'm sure you'll want to talk about in a bit. But that was my way in.
So we talked earlier, I guess, about like the idea of page to stage. Like Matthew had this idea, and then you have to mount it. And first of all, let's also mention that this is an adaptation. This isn't like the original script that they just put on stage. Jack Thorne, who's done Harry Potter, and it's playing in New York right now, and I believe it's still playing in London, but he readapted the script for this telling of it. So how did you kind of adapt the music for it, and where did you start? What was your start? Like, okay, we have this idea. What am I going to do with it? How did you begin your production process?
Well, so the first thing was to look at the carols that we had put in at key moments in the show, in the production. So Jack had chosen quite a few. I chose quite a few, and so did Matthew. And we all talked about what would be the best carol to match this particular scene. And I think that was the idea, actually. That was one of the philosophies of it, was to mark each scene with a Christmas carol. What would be the kind of underscore for a particular moment in the story? What would be a good Christmas carol to mark that? So actually, honestly, that was probably the first starting point. That was the choice of carols to go in any particular scene.
And how did you pick them? What was the process behind that like? Secular, more non-secular, what was the process?
Well, that's a really good question. and I can give you some examples, because they're slightly different reasons and for each choice, actually. So there was no real hard and fast rule, because obviously a carol hasn't necessarily got words to it that match specifically what's happening in the story. I mean, I would say musically, we would try and find something that matched something first. So, for instance, the ghost of Christmas Present comes to visit Scrooge, and the carol that we chose for that moment was In the Bleak Midwinter, which is personally one of my favourite carols ever. Most beautiful tune, and it's very calm. And it had reached a point in the story where Scrooge has been visited by the first ghost. He's skeptical. He's thinking, oh my gosh, what now? Who's next? And along comes this second ghost who's actually fairly kindly to him and shows him a vision of London. She stands there and shows him a kind of rooftop vision of 1840s London. And that's the vision I had in my head. And I thought, well, of course, In the Bleak Midwinter is a perfect description of that. It's a bit cliched, let's be honest. But, you know, it's a vision of rooftops covered in snow, of cold, of people wanting to be inside, and a kind of warm feeling. So that was one carol. That was a fairly easy choice. Another one was the Coventry Carol, which is probably one of the most sad carols. It's beautiful, but it is genuinely, it's got most awful lyrics, really. And, you know, how does it go? It's the verses, Herod the king and his raging, it is all young children be slain. I mean, it's not exactly Christmassy. It's most chilling feeling and chilling emotion. But because of this, it was perfect for this very terrifying moment for Scrooge, when he now sees the ghost of Christmas Future, who's described by Dickens in the book as being, you know, terrifying him. He's absolutely terrified by this. So Coventry Carol felt like a good accompaniment to that kind of very bleak, scary moment, chilling moment for Scrooge. Those are two examples that, I mean, I can try. I'll probably try and describe lots more. I mean, one of them, Midnight Clear. It came upon a Midnight Clear, not most famous carol, but it's lovely. It's very playful, and I think that carol is great for when Scrooge is being introduced to the first ghost, and there's this sense that the spirits from in heaven are looking down on Scrooge and inviting him to the party, inviting him to join in this game that he's being visited by these, and so it's quite playful, and that suited for that reason. So there's lots of different reasons why each carol got chosen.
Something I've noticed in your description of them is that you picked a lot of carols that might not be necessarily, I mean, there is Silent Night, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, and all of that is in there, but you picked a lot of carols that aren't the most mainstream. Was that a conscious choice? Because we've discussed off the air, and we could discuss on the air, obviously, that when you were talking about doing something like Silent Night, you didn't want to mess it up because people have such an expectation of it. But is that why you picked some more lesser-known carols that could more fit the story and people didn't have a preconceived notion of what it was going in?
That's a really good question. I don't think there was a conscious choice. Maybe subconsciously, yes. I mean, I suppose we didn't want, we also didn't really want people to be completely distracted by what they were hearing. You know, if there's a beautiful carol playing, you know, your attention could be split between watching and following the story and then listening to the carol itself. I think also culturally they're different. I've noticed there are definitely differences between the US and the UK of what's a famous carol and what's not. I think Joy to the World, for instance, is quite a big carol in the US. I'm not sure, you might correct me, but in the UK it's not particularly famous, but it is in there. You know, hard and fast rule about, we weren't trying to just find things that weren't well known, but you know, a good side effect of that was that they're not too distracting. We didn't want them to you know, distract from the story.
At this time, we're just going to remind our audience that they are listening to the One Road Community Radio Show, and we're so glad that they're here on 80.7 FM, WRG Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa. We are with Chris Nightingale, the composer, orchestrator, and arranger of A Christmas Carol, playing at the Perelman Center in New York City now through January 4th. And we were talking about the music in the show. So you pick the songs, you have this idea of what it is, and what's the next step? The arrangements? How do you work it into the story? The actors, musicians? Tell us about that process.
Yes, good question. So the next part of that process is, once the carols have been chosen, is mainly just sitting terrified in a rehearsal room for me. It's sitting there thinking, oh my God, am I going to write here to mark this scene? But it's an extraordinarily, I love it. It's the best process ever. Being surrounded by actors who are performing and finding their own way with the story. And honestly, what I used to do is sit, I tend to sit in the room with a piano, and the piano might kind of turn down quite a lot, and just sort of fiddle around and see what fits. And one of a lovely thing is, especially when you've got a very musical cast, as this were in their very first production, is they'll respond to that. And it becomes something quite intriguing. I you know, I might play something and then I'll find that the actor themselves is timing their speeches to the music or playing. So it becomes a kind of, this sounds so pretentious, honestly, I'm sorry, but, you know, a kind of musical conversation. I remember there was a moment that happened with Rhys Ifans, who played Scrooge originally, who's a wonderful actor, Welsh actor in his country. There was a scene between him and Belle. Belle is the love that he never had, but he goes to visit her at the end after he's feeling redeemed. And I remember it was just the two actors standing there and me with a piano, and it's kind of terrifying and exposing, because I play something and it might be absolute rubbish. It might hit some kind of nerve somewhere. And while I was playing, I know that there was, that Rhys in particular was responding to this and was answering. And it was fun for me to try and follow the emotion of the scene. So that's kind of, I mean, that's a very long-winded way to describe what happens in rehearsals, but that is kind of the feeling. You try and find the right adjective to describe the scene, and then kind of just try stuff out. And when it's a really friendly acting environment, people respond really generously or not. That's how I first approach things.
And then how, because you were sitting there with the piano, how do you shift it based on different actors, different cultures you're playing it for? Like you were saying, Joy to the World is a very big song here in the United States. I heard it the other day, And you were saying in the United Kingdom, it's not really that big. How do you shift it, or not as well known, rather, I should say. How do you shift the music, or have you been like, this isn't working, let's shift this, as you do the production year by year? Are you allowed to make those changes? Are you allowed to make a change based on what different audiences are responding to you, based on different parts of the world you're playing in? How does that work?
Yeah, that does. Yes, absolutely. That happens. I mean, for a start, I mean, from just a very kind of purely technical level, actors do things at different speeds, clearly. And you know, it would be wrong for the script, the story, the production to be the same thing every, you know, it'd be tied down every year. It needs to be this. It needs to be at this pace. Things change, and the shape of the music underneath a scene might have to change, but particularly because the way a particular actor is approaching it. I mean, that's kind of normal, and it hasn't happened that much, if I'm honest, but certainly cutting and adding little bits here and there has had to happen. And that's good. It means, you know, revisiting the score, connecting with the new Scrooge or new actors, and just trying to make it relevant for whatever that particular production is. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to fit. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It has to be a little bit bespoke.
And now we'll get to, we've discussed the production process. It's opening night, no matter where it is. What have you seen the audience responding to the music? What has been the response to that?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. I'm mostly just terrified of that stuff. I mean, I'm terrible opening nights. I tend to listen to the score and just think, oh my gosh, I can hear all the things that are wrong, you know. Oh, this isn't timed out right, or it doesn't sound quite right, or it's not loud enough, it's not soft enough, it's not, you know. So I'm an absolute nightmare to sit next to on an opening night, just to warn you if that ever might happen. Just don't do it, because I twitch and I fidget and I, but you know, I've had an amazing response from the music. I mean, so much so, for my own little plug, I recorded the music at last and made a proper recording of it, because there was a bit of head of steam on for people to want to listen to it at home. So I have done that eventually. It's taken me 9 years, but I'm certainly not the best judge of whether the music is any good or not. I mean, I'm very gratified that people do seem to really enjoy it, but it's probably down to the carols, quite honestly.
All right, you set us up perfectly. Let's talk about this album. How'd the album come together? How's it different from the show? Tell us about that.
Well, I decided to do the album because I thought it was wrong not to. I really wanted to have a record of it. I don't mean, you know, no pun intended, as in a remembrance of the score. But I think, unlike it, it's very much, actually, in many ways, A Christmas Carol is a bit like a musical. You know, it uses music very overtly. It's not like it's just hidden underscore. It plays a very very big part. But what couldn't have happened, and what you can do in a musical if you're making a cast album, for instance, is you can just pretty much transfer the music straight onto a, you know, it converts very easily. This does not, because, you know, a lot of the carols, we hint at the carols, and then it, you know, for reasons that the production, for the story has to keep going, the carols might disappear and become kind of more underscory. So what I thought I'd do was not really make a cast album per se, but make a collection of all the music that's in the show into, and expand it and turn it into something that's inspired by the music in the show. So all the music that's in the show is on the album, but it's been expanded, you know, and whereas we might have done maybe one verse of God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, now we do the whole lot. And I've recorded it with his most wonderful choir. I mean, they are exceptional, world-class tenebrae who are run by Nigel Short in this country, in the UK, but they perform worldwide. And they have most beautiful, clear voices. So I was so excited when they agreed to do it. And so those things... it took a lot of expanding to get it into a new shape. But as soon as I had the tenebrae on board, I was, you know, full steam ahead.
Elaborate more on the expanding, if you could.
Well, for instance, I mean, some of them are not for the... Basically, it's Silent Night. In the show, Silent Night is one last bell-ringing carol that is done after the curtain call. And I thought, I can't do a whole album of singing and not have this choir, this particular choir, sing Silent Night. So I had to sit down. I thought, this is ridiculous. Well, I need to try and do both. Incorporate all the handbell ringing, but also let's just sing it. It's the most beautiful carol ever. It took a bit of time and a bit of thought, but I found a way to incorporate both the bell ringing and the singing into it. And so that's kind of why I did a version of it. I just felt it would be shortchanging people just to hear kind of random music cues and not hear the full intended kind of logical conclusion of one of the carols, of how the carols interact with the show. So it's kind of hybrid. It's like it's more of a carol, but also it still has the underscore and basically the description of the story.
And I think, because as someone who saw the production in 2019, that moment with the bells, especially when the young actor playing Tiny Tim at the end rings that final bell cue, it's so moving, the whole thing, because it's just kind of something you're singing and you just kind of take it back by it, because it's a reinvention of it. Like, we could talk about that too, reinventing these beloved carols, and I could see how that couldn't transfer over, because that's an image versus audio. Audio and video are, not video, but audio and a real life image are two very different mediums and have very different effects on people. So I guess I could see why you did that, where you made that call when you were transferring it from the stage to the recording.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's true. Of course, you don't have the benefit of seeing Tiny Tim ring that little bell at the end, which, like you say, is it's gold dust, you know, emotion. It's just, oh my gosh, it's so sweet and lovely, and it just is the final full stop to the production. I mean, but I didn't have that benefit on a CD, do I? So you have to imagine it. But I still think you get the sense of that kind of community, the bells playing it. But yeah, that's a really good point. I had to take that into account.
And something else, we were talking about the humanity of the story. Another carol that was not on my radar before I came across your production, See Amidst the Winter Snow. I don't know if that's as prominent in the United States as it is. It might be in the United Kingdom. I know there's a Julie Andrews version of it out there that I listened to once I found out about the song. But something, we were talking about the humanity and kind of the rawness of the production that touches you on a very human level. That all starts out a cappella, no music, no nothing in the background, no instrumental. And I think that kind of sound too also makes it just this very raw human thing that you're experiencing on the album and in person.
No, that's so true. And yes, I mean, actually, that was that's a really interesting carol that you've noticed, because See Amid the Winter Snow is kind of relatively famous over here. I'm not sure if it's in the top 10 or not, probably like number 9 or something. But yeah, we thought that it's the moment of basically Scrooge makes a promise. It's like he makes a promise to the world. He makes a promise to the ghosts and the spirits around him that he will change. He will try and honor Christmas from henceforth. Kind of, that's basically his promise. And then it's basically like a light goes on. And in the theater, I think you'll remember that the voice sings the first line or the first couple of lines of See Amid from the back of the theatre. And in the Old Vic in London, it's different for every theatre, but it's, you know, it's right at the top at the back. So it's in the gods, and there she appears, the actress singing it. And she has to pick the note out of the blue. And it's the performance style is very, very different. And that's not traditional as a carol, because actually years ago, Matthew and I, we worked with a Finnish band, a band from Finland called, I hope I pronounce it right, but Vartina. And they were an extraordinary outfit, a folk band. And they taught me this kind of singing, which happens, I think, in the east of Finland, where there is a point to this story, by the way, where they call out over vast distances. It was like kind of singing across the tundra. And that was this vision that we had, was that this is a moment where basically the world is waking up. The world wakes up on Christmas morning Scrooge has made his promise to the world, and the world is responding with this beautiful carol, but sung completely a cappella and completely raw, as you said. That's a really good word to use. It is very, very raw, and it's like he's undressed. He's like, he's naked to the world, so to speak. You know, emotionally, he's completely empty. He's gone through this incredible journey, and there he is on his own. And this was a representation of that. So the raw sound of that carol, a cappella, you know, nearly cracking maybe, you know, it's difficult, really difficult to sing it. It just felt like a perfect accompaniment to what he has been going through and what he's woken up and promised.
It's like, I guess you could say, just your interpretation of, like, a heart uncracking a little bit, because it's touching something inside of you. The same with Tiny Tim. I don't know if that was something tonally you were trying to strike with the music, because I know you're saying you're very nervous about audience reception. You've been getting a lot of audience reception this whole interview, so I'm just curious if I'm getting what you were intending. What was your intention, and what has it even been from other audience members? What have you heard their response to the music?
Yeah, I've heard like wonderful things about the music. I mean, some things you get for free, you know. I mean, a child standing in the middle of a stage in front of 1,000 people and having the guts to do that and shaking Scrooge's hand, you know, I could write more or less anything, any music underneath that, and it's going to make people cry. So some things are very easy to do. But I don't know. I love that. I'm sort of astonished that people get as much out of it as they do. I think I keep returning to this word. I think it's because if I manage to do anything, I hope it's to try and invoke a feeling of nostalgia in people. I think that's an incredibly strong emotion, because, you know, we'll remember remember different things about Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, maybe, or whatever it is at that time. And I guess I think I feel sometimes like I've slightly cheated, because I've managed to surf on that particular wave, which is, you know, there are technically reasons why it's quite difficult to say. But I mean, if you're trying to write or compose some music that's nostalgic, almost by default, it's possible that it's going to sound like something else. So it's very easy for it to be too cliched. And I'm very conscious of that when I listen back and I think, oh God, is that too familiar? Is that too cliched? Have I pushed too close to being over familiar? You know, anyway, I'm letting you into my own personal neuroses. So I shall stop. I shall stop now.
No, it's interesting. We're getting your insight into the production process and the music. That's why I brought you on to talk today. I'm curious, how do you strike that balance where you feel like, oh, like if you have everybody just singing Silent Night, like you kind of were saying, the work is already done for you, and with Tiny Tim ringing the bell and the nostalgia. So how do you strike that balance of reinventing something but keeping what's true and keeping that nostalgia there for people?
So yeah, striking the balance between trying to make something familiar or not. The difference, that's right. The difference is talking about film and theatre, and the difference of writing music for both is that in film it's set, but you don't have access to the actors. So the actors in a theatre production in the rehearsal room might be a 6-week, 5-week, whatever rehearsal period. You know, I'm in there most of the time, and you get a sense working with them you get an amazing sense of feedback from them. It makes it much easier to write a piece of music. And, you know, in a way, if I'm thinking, oh, does this sound like something, I could just shout it out in the room. Oh my gosh, does this sound like something everyone's heard before? And then luckily, if it's no, then I'll go, okay, it's a keeper. But it is a very hard balance technically to try and kind of basically to juggle between keeping things fresh enough, but also make it feel like it's something that you've heard before without it literally be something that you have heard before.
But I think the emotions of it I think, play to your advantage a little bit, because like you were saying in the beginning, who wants to see another Christmas Carol? And clearly a lot of people do, because you have the nostalgia of the story people know, music that they know, but it's a different telling of it, and I think that might be what's getting people.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's interesting. I was asked the other day, what was my introduction to A Christmas Carol myself? You know, the story. And it was my dad. My dad read it to... He went through a period of trying to start a tradition, I think. But he's a very literary man himself. But he sat and read to us every Christmas Eve. He tried it. I think it worked twice. He managed to read the story to the family twice. But I remember it very clearly, sitting there. You know, it's a bit of a cliche, but there we were in front of the fire. He was reading Christmas Carol. It's such a great story because it appeals on so many levels to adults and to children. You know, we talked a little bit about how the story appeals to adults, that feeling of, you know, getting lost and stuck, maybe in a career or just in life or whatever. And as a child, it's a thrilling story because you've got ghosts and, you know, intrigue, and there's, you know, incredibly imaginative stuff. So it's this sort of amazingly appealing story. And that was my introduction to it, was Dad attempting to read it to us. I mean, I think I was about 7 or 8, so I really was more interested in what was going to be happening the next day.
But I think you touched on something that I remember. As you talk about your father, I weirdly started thinking about my parents, and I wasn't getting emotional per se, but just kind of like, you just kind of felt it in your heart. Because I remember going with my parents to see this, and Christmases with my parents, and going to see this show with them, and even different things that are going on in New York and different traditions of things with people. I think that is some. I think that's part of it too.
That's right. Yeah, it is. And as we've discussed, it's this feeling, no matter, you know, at a special time, whatever that feast is, or festival or whatever, whether it's Christmas or something else, it is a time for family. It is a time for coming together. Creating traditions themselves is part of Christmas as well, isn't it? Whatever that might be, like you say, your dad took you to the theatre or something, and that became a Christmas tradition. Or I remember I used to take my son to around Christmas to a famous toy store in London called Hamleys, and that became a thing, you know. But they have this kind of red hot as emotions. They're not small things. They, even though the event, you could do it, you know, the same trip in August or in, I don't know, March, it's completely different when it's around Christmas. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just this feral thing in all of us that we want to kind of curl up and think of home when it gets cold, and, you know, sit around a fire or whatever it is. But it's an incredibly strong emotion for sure. And that is, like, you know, as we've been talking about, is what makes... Certainly writing music for something like this, it's sort of kind of slightly cheating. a lot of it is done for you straight away, just because of how raw the emotions are.
Well, don't sell yourself short, Chris, as cheating. You won the Tony Award for this after all, so don't sell yourself short about that. Don't sell yourself short with the cheating.
I know. Okay, I'm told I should not do that. I shouldn't show. But no one is more surprised than me about the Tony Award, I must say. But I am, you know, I was absolutely thrilled. I couldn't really believe it. But thank you. I shall endeavor not to sell myself short.
Excellent, excellent. And before we wrap up, we were talking about, like, this nostalgia of our childhoods and Christmas. I think that really is what it is. I think seeing the Rockefeller Center tree here in New York City, and the windows and the lights, I think there is this feeling of, as a child, you were just so, like, awestruck by it. And I think this production has that element of awestruck as well, with the bells and the visual and just how the whole thing is put together.
That's so kind of you to say. It's true. I think what you're saying, I watched it the other day in London. I've not been lucky enough to get over to New York to see this production actually yet. You know, in London, I watched it, and I was astonished by the audience reaction. Honestly, it's just, I think there's a confidence about the way it's presented on stage as well, which just makes you set the audience settle in their seats, and they just feel kind of a sense of, I don't know, confidence really about it. And okay, please take me on this journey. I'm really up for it. It's raining outside. It's miserable. Everything else is a bit miserable at the moment. So let's just have this nice story about of redemption. And gosh, it's hit a nail on the head, that's for sure.
Warm and fuzzy feelings. And lastly, before we do wrap up, Chris, I want to ask you this last question. We've discussed how people have made this a part of their Christmas traditions. People want to take the music home with them. That's why you made the album. I know you've said the whole time you're astonished by the audience reaction. What is that feeling like, that we've talked about the traditions and nostalgia and childhood and all these themes are associated with this time of year? What does it mean that people now are making your show and your music and your album, that's all now going to be a part of their traditions?
It means the world. It means the world to her. And none of us, going back to that moment in New York, actually, in 2016 or whatever it was, when Matthew tried to persuade us all to do the show, never did we imagine that it would be coming back over and over again. And I'm just so grateful to the people who enjoy it. And and long may it continue. I really think it's something that is designed to try and cheer people up. Maybe that's part of it.
If you could describe your show in one word as a final takeaway for people, what would it be?
Oh my gosh, that's so unfair. Okay, let me think. I'm going to say warm.
That's it. You get that warm, like we were saying, it's a warm, fuzzy feeling you get. And I think that's why it's transferred so well all over the world. Because again, like we were saying, this show, we're one world. We have that same shared humanity that's in the story, it's in the music, and it's in your production. So thank you, Chris, for sharing that with us. And thank you for all for doing this production.
You're so very welcome. And thank you for it. It was lovely to meet you. I should have used the word fuzzy, but wouldn't have been such a great image somehow.
And before we go, I do want to mention, with the production in New York, there's a River Fund donation, and at each performance, donations will be collected directly to benefit River Fund. River Fund empowers individuals and families to move beyond the lines of poverty through food stability, access to benefits, and educational pathways. So I thought that was also worth mentioning for the audience, should they desire to go see your show.
Absolutely, yes. And it's a big thing about our production also is that it has collected an enormous amount for charities, local charities, which wherever it plays, whatever local charity is relevant to the setting, it has received a huge amount of money over the years now. It's an amazing thing, actually.
And Chris, if people want to go see the production in New York, where can they turn to? It's playing at the Perelman Center through January 4th, is that correct?
That is correct. It's the Perelman Center, and I guess tickets are available in the normal way.
The normal way, whatever that might be for you. Chris, thank you so much for coming on, and enjoy your holiday season.
You're so kind. It's a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for taking the time yourself. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the One World Community Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU Radio Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time.
listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
I mean, the public relations industry does not spend over $1 billion a year for fun. The public relations industry was created, and it's an American invention, was created in the early part of the century, as its leaders put it, to control the public mind, which they said is the greatest danger facing corporations.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on manufacturing consent. The media like to present themselves as objective, balanced, and free from any bias or agenda. Reality suggests something quite different. The media function as weapons of mass distraction. Much of what passes as news is sometimes subtle, sometimes crude propaganda. The media are large conglomerates that serve to mobilize support for the special interests that dominate state and corporate power. In democratic societies, populations are not...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh.